Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 16-115, State v. Baker. Arguing for petitioner Dwight Lum. Arguing for respondent Sonia McCullen. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Lum and Ms. McCullen. You're both ready to proceed today? All right. So, Mr. Lum, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll have a warning light at 10 minutes to go, and we'll have a warning light for you as well, Ms. McCullen, with 10 minutes to go in your argument. Please proceed.
May it please the court, I'll be doing the argument basically starting with the voluntariness of the statement, and then the next issue I'd be going into would be, I guess, excluding that portion of the statement that went in regarding his past history about being raped when he was a child, and thirdly, regarding issues regarding the consecutive sentence that was imposed upon Mr. Baker. On the voluntariness issue, we're asking the court to take a look at totality of the circumstances because, okay, one thing they're pointing out is that he did give a statement that he, I guess, even though he'd taken drugs before the marijuana and the crack, and his mind was clear, but we're saying that if you look at what he said throughout the statement, he wasn't really, I guess not in the right mind, but he was still feeling the effects of stress. He was feeling the effects of drug withdrawal, and he was thus susceptible and, I guess, vulnerable to the cajoling and, I guess, persuasive tactics that was used by the police detective Tokita. His state of mind, there was mention that he had ADHD as a child, and he had to take it for about a year, and then he stopped, not because he felt better, but because his father slowly told him, oh, you don't need that. So he didn't get treatment. So to that present day, I would presume that he was still suffering from that. Okay. Next was that there were, yes, as I said, drugs that he had previously used. At one point in the interview, he tells the officer when they were discussing his drug use, he says he knows and understands, I do know I gotta stop, but I can't. Okay, he says, I don't know what to do. He talks about using the crack all day and says that before he spoke, he said he wanted to smoke a joint, he wanted to smoke a cigarette, he wanted to drink something. He was trying to sleep, but he couldn't, and he wanted something in his body. To me, those are clear and obvious signs of cravings and drug withdrawal. The other things that were pointed out was, okay, the officer pointed out that his nigh brother, his cousin, whom his initials GK, was in custody and that he was also being charged. There was discussion about how a person like him, if he's, I guess, comes out in publicity, that would really look bad for him. So that's one of his concerns, that his family would find out about him. So
doesn't there need to be an accompanying threat? Like if you don't give a statement, I'm going to publicize it. Just to speculate about, wow, this girl is a minor. It looks bad. That's the context of the statement. So there was no accompanying threat, was there?
No, we are saying that there was an implicit threat because letting him know that this is going to get out into the public realm and his family is going to learn about it. So,
was that if you don't give a statement, it'll get out? You're just talking factually, it just gets out and it's really bad.
And so I guess that's why part of this was, okay, the detective was trying to get him to admit that he beat up the girl, that he was the one that caused those severe and horrific injuries to her. You know, during the interview, his insistence was that it was the Hanai brother, GK, who had used the bottle. And if you look at the testimony from the complaining witness, her initial statement to the police was that it was GK who hit her with a bottle and caused her to black out. And we're saying that must have been a pretty hard hit if it's strong enough for her to, you know, get blacked out from that one blow. And we believe, argument, that was the main reason why she had all that blood coming out of her face.
Okay. Doesn't it sound like, I mean, to follow up Justice Nakayama's question, it sounds like when he said, let me tell you what it sounds like on the outside. The girl's a minor, so she's not an adult. So in people's minds, if you know this hits the media, in other words, if you don't confess, this thing may end up in the media.
Well, you're saying that that was the basic, like I said, was not explicitly stated, but we believe that was implicitly implied. And one of the things he worked on was that, you know, how much he cared for his family and how much he basically did not want.
So the concern was that the family would find out because of media publicity? Why wouldn't the family find out anyway if he was charged?
Well, he was concerned about the details because one of the things he talked about later on was being painted as a chronic, you know, as somebody who used crack. These were things he didn't want to have brought out. So we're arguing that, okay, basically what it came down to was kind of like giving him a choice. Okay, you can admit to having sex with this young girl or other things such as the beating, the severity of the injuries you receive, you're being a crack user, all these other things would come out from the media. So,
wasn't the fact that Mr. Tokita tried very hard to get Mr. Baker to admit that he had hit her? And he, except for towards the end, he was saying, okay, maybe I directed Gabe to hit her. But he had said, he maintained that. And he explained to the detective how Gabe had hit her in the face with the bottle. And that's why the injury. So isn't that evidence that he wasn't subjected to overmastering influence of the detective if he never wavered from saying that he never hit her?
No, we're saying that what it came down to was, okay, you can either admit that you hit her and beat her and knocked her unconscious and then raped her, or you can just say that you had sex with her, presumably without consent, because Gabe had previously beaten her unconscious. So it's like giving him a choice. Either you admit to doing all these horrific things and raping her, or just admit to having sex with her.
But he didn't. He Justice Nakayama's question is, he maintained that fairly consistently, at least until the very end, that he had not hit her with the bottle. And he said, you know, the one thing I'm, in effect, the one thing I'm not going to admit to is I didn't hit her. So how is his will overborne if he's making what appear to be choices between what he does acknowledge and what he doesn't acknowledge? How is that consistent with your theory that his will was somehow overborne in this instance?
Well, there was the other part that the detective, you know, lied to him about the DNA evidence, okay? The detective admitted that it was used as an interrogation technique, telling him that they had positive DNA evidence linking him to the semen that was found in the complaining witness.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Lum, but since you're on that point, I guess you're making the point that the DNA evidence that was made up, if you will, by the officer somehow affected the voluntariness. But in terms of Kelly-Kaleo, this distinction of extrinsic versus intrinsic evidence seemed to be of importance. So when you're explaining this concept of confession, or as I understand it, you were also arguing that the officer suggested, although I'm not sure this is your analysis, but suggested that somehow the media would not be covering the case, certainly not to the same extent, if he were to confess. So in terms of these two facts that you're suggesting indicate involuntariness, how would you relate that to intrinsic versus extrinsic facts?
Well, the intrinsic fact, when they use that factor, the analysis is whether it makes a person confess to something they otherwise would not, you know, and that's why we're saying that, okay, what he was basically telling Mr. Baker was, okay, if you admit to having sex with the girl, then the other part, okay, about actually beating her and hitting her and all these things, I don't want to say mitigate, but it would sound less severe if it did get out, if he just admitted to having sex with a young girl rather than the other things. So it's like lying about the facts, saying, okay, we got you about on the DNA and saying you definitely, it's incontrovertible that you had sex with her, so you might as well admit that, and then leave him to think, okay, if I would admit that, then the other parts about, you know, the Bacardi bottle or the Jack Daniels bottle would not be used against me, or they won't try to say that I was the one that did it if I just say I was the one that actually had sex with her.
Okay, because to the transcript of the where that said.
Well, he didn't tell him that explicitly.
Well,
what was he saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he told. Well, we're saying that by starting off with the DNA evidence, he makes a situation for Mr. Baker that, okay, we already have you on having sex with her. So it's like saying that if you get, you should at very least, admit to that to us. He didn't come right out and say that, but we think that that was implied by telling him or lying to him about having DNA evidence linking him to the crime.
By saying that, that's an implied threat or something?
Well, not a threat, but telling him, basically putting in his mind that, okay, we have you on DNA evidence.
Which is allowable under Kalicolia.
Okay.
Right?
Well, we're saying that it was part of, even though it was an intrinsic factor, we're saying that under totality of circumstances, which is the overall test, it was used as, I'd say, a pressure point to get him to say, I had sex, rather than going all the way and saying, oh, I had sex, and I beat her up.
But could you help me with Justice Nakayama's point about the nature of the DNA lie? There was a determination made by the officer when interrogating Mr. Baker that it was necessary to not tell the truth and that it would be useful to make up the idea that DNA evidence was actually available and proven it, right? Why is that any different than what happened in Kalicolio, where there was also fabrication by the police officer?
Well, we distinguish it from Kalicolio by saying that, once again, the actual evidence of him being the one to, say, use the bottle against the complaining witness was very sketchy, since she, in her initial statement, said it was GK who did it. We're saying that it was not explicitly stated, but part of a strategy to get him to admit or connect himself to the crime by saying that he had actually had sex with the young girl in the first place.
Mr. Lyon, excuse me. Kalicolio, we've been talking about that, and Kalicolio reaffirms, in a sense, or relies on U.S. Supreme Court precedent. Basically, the U.S. Supreme Court held, and you referred to it earlier, that outright lies don't put innocent people at risk. And Kalicolio kind of said the same thing. It referred to this well-settled principle, apparently a legal principle, that the use of trickery alone doesn't produce untrue confessions. Now, that was said in the early 90s, and I think we've learned a lot since the 1990s. We've had case after case, some of them, like the Central Park jogger case, where four innocent kids all confessed to sex assault, and the Norfolk, the famous Norfolk case, where four Navy guys all confessed to a rape murder. They're all false confessions, and ultimately they catch the real person. And we've seen, there's figures that 25% of all of the DNA exonerations are from false confessions. So this premise that Kalicolio begins with, that innocent people aren't susceptible to lies, is that a valid concept? And is that a valid legal concept?
I asked the court to reconsider that at this time, because part of this case was in the court's holding on the voluntariness. She found, like, she excluded the last five pages because she believed the police officer went overboard in being suggestive about Mr. Baker being the one to tell his brother to use the bottle.
Perhaps you can explain to me, and I'm going to ask the prosecutor the same question. What is it about the last four or five pages that is different than what came before? In fact, the officer seems more controlled in the last four or five pages than he was earlier.
Part of our request, but we're saying that if you listen to the audio, it's the officer that's making all the suggestions during the first, prior to the last, the first 37 pages, saying, for instance, after Mr. Baker denies it and says that, you know, it was his brother who initially started it, then he says, you know, I know it's a lie, and then he lays out a scenario, and he doesn't just lay out a short scenario that you were the one who did it. He says, you know, first you went on, and then my brother GK went on, then you went on again, and then you entered in. And so he doesn't just say, I don't believe you, tell me the truth. He's laying out these scenarios, and at first Mr. Baker denies it, and at the end he doesn't admit, he just says, okay, I'm not going to fight you anymore. And we believe that if you look at the entire thing, the officer was using coercive techniques and suggesting the answers, and all he wanted was not the truth, but to get the defendant to agree with him. And once he got that, you know, he said, I'm not going to fight you anymore, then he would move on to the next thing to try to get him to admit something else.
How long did this interview last? Like 45 minutes, something like that?
Yes, we believe it was a little less than
okay,
an
hour. Okay, so are you arguing that officers can't challenge a defendant about the truthfulness of what they say? Isn't that classically or something that was ruled on in Kelly Colio?
No, that's what I'm saying. He went beyond saying that you're not being truthful. He said, you're not telling the truth, and then he lays out this scenario. This is dumb, 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 dumb.
Officer can't do that? The officer can't? And then, officer cannot articulate the theory of the case and ask the defendant to respond?
Well, and then he, you know, and when, even when he initially denied it, he came back again. I think it was two or three times saying that this is what happened, you're lying, this is what happened. And he went right with his scenario that was first him, then GK, then him again. None of that came actually from the defendant's lips. Okay, this was, we're saying that he went too far in saying, this is what I believe happened, and I just want you to agree with me. Well, we think that he went too far, that it's one thing to just lay out the end scenario, and then if he denies it, move on to something else, but he kept pressing him. And we're saying that if you look at other factors, he said the stress that Mr. Baker was under, that he was worried about what would happen if there was actual large spread of publicity about the case, and once again, thoughts about taking the blame in order to protect his Hanai brother. That eventually wore him down to the point where he would say, okay, I give up, I'm going to agree to everything you tell me.
I'd like to ask your help, Mr. Lum, on analyzing the concept that the manufacturing of evidence by the government is, it appears, considered to be a proper tactic as long as it doesn't cause an involuntary confession. So this idea that it's a proper tactic, I wanted to get your sense of where the limits are. How would you define, I mean, obviously totality of the circumstances has to be looked at, but at this time it seems that the analysis again focuses on whether or not the individual has been coerced to the point where their confession is involuntary. But is there another factor that a court should consider just in terms of the public policy implications of police officers manufacturing evidence? Should that be involved at all in our analysis in totality of circumstances, or should it only be looking at the degree to which the police make up evidence?
Well, I think that one of the things is that the entire concept of it being all right for the police to tell lies to the person being interrogated being acceptable is not even generally known, I'd say, among the public. And so when they go into these interviews, you know, it never occurs to them that a police officer is going to lie to them. If it comes out that it's considered standard and acceptable behavior, then persons who are going to see or talk to a police officer are going to have to take second thoughts and saying, nothing this guy says may be true. Everything he says may be oriented toward getting me to make it an admission of guilt without any regard to giving the truth. So once again, this, you know, the whole concept about it's okay to tell these falsehoods to get the proper confession, you know, is usually basically, I guess, in the legal community. You don't see it, you know, discussed in the newspapers or the media, even though here, you know, we accept it as, okay, this is written on the tablets and you have to accept it. But if you look at the general public, if somebody is being arrested and asked to come in and give a statement, they'll say to themselves, why should I, if nothing this officer says to me is going to be true about the case?
In terms of the voluntariness under Kelly-Colio, in terms of the totality of circumstances, the defendant's mental and physical condition can be a part of the totality of circumstances relevant to the issue of voluntariness. Is there anything in the record that reflects what was going on in the 11 hours or so after he was arrested and the time of the beginning of the interrogation?
I don't believe so. His statement was that his father told him to turn himself in. And
I thought he was arrested while he was reporting to the work.
His father told him to turn himself in. He didn't. He went to work, and the police found him there and took him into custody.
That was at 8 o'clock in the morning, so I'm wondering what happened between 8 o'clock in the morning until 6:45 p.m. or so when this interview started.
I don't believe that's...
The record doesn't reflect that.
Yeah. The only thing I have regarding that is Mr. Baker's words that he could not speak, that he wanted to get something into his body.
Mr. Lim, I just want to ask you again, so if I understand, your theory is that the police pounded this version of facts into him and forced him to acknowledge in a very summary fashion. But if you look at the way he described what happened is that earlier, as I mentioned, he continues to insist he didn't beat the complaining witness. And he also talks at length about what happened after these events. He talks about, you know, talking to her and saying, we had a conversation. I was like, sweetie, I'm so sorry. She was like, no, it's okay. I was like, no, it's not. I don't even know why I did this. I picked her up. He says, I helped her put on her clothes. I said, where's your socks? She said, I don't know. I was like, sweetheart, are you okay? I looked her in the face. Now, are those the kinds of that you're, how was it that the officer put those thoughts in his head? How did the officer suggest to him to share an anecdote about helping her find her socks?
Well, that part, instead, is part and parcel of his willing to admit to, or getting him to admit that he had sex with the girl, but what he really wanted was for him to admit that, which while he actually beat her and caused those injuries to her. We're saying that in Mr. Baker's mind, okay, it's better to show that there was some sex involved rather than say, okay, I had sex because I beat her and caused these severe injuries.
So your theory is that he made those details up to curry favor with the officer?
Basically, yes, that, you know, he wanted to show that he did take care of her afterwards and that he didn't, I guess, that she appeared, I don't want to say well, that, you know, that somebody would be there to help take care of her when he said he had handed her over to that other girl, initials LK.
I'm just supposing, because the girl was not unconscious, the officer is assuming, the detective's assuming she was hit on the head with the bottle. So he's going, asking Mr. Baker, you know, admit that she was hit on the head with the bottle. And Baker said, no, I'm telling you, Dave smashed her in the face with the bottle. And I saw it, he smashed her in the face, which accounts to the severe injuries that she had on her face. So he is sticking up for himself and explaining what actually happened and what he saw in her body. How can that mean that he's caving in to the officer and giving in, because he is steadfast that he did not hear with that bottle?
Well, because what the prosecution in their closing argument brought in, you know, they said, okay, he admitted to having sex with her. The part that they dispute was that, you know, saying that he was lying about that she hit her with the bottle or punched her. And so saying they brought that in as the first part of the case, saying, okay, it's undisputed that he had sex with her, and all they have to next show is that he was one that caused these injuries by bringing in the testimony of the complaining witness, but also partially bringing in what the brother had said, or admitted he said during his cross-examination, that he claimed that it was, in his statement, that it was Mr. Baker who instructed him or told him to use the bottle.
And ultimately, they get Mr. Baker to agree to virtually everything, right? I mean, they even get him at the end to admit that you told him what, to get himself involved, so they get him to say that he told the brother to get himself involved. In other words, he told the brother what to do. Hit her over the head, right, with the bottle, yeah, to have sex with her. He gets Baker, essentially, not denying anything that the officer pretty much had theorized what the officer believed had occurred.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you listen to the entire audio, the way it proceeds is initially he does deny, and then he gives his version of events. That's what I'm saying. If, even though it would say it's less than an hour, it doesn't take that long if a person has had a lack of sleep and everything to basically have his, I guess, mental faculties depleted to the point where he would agree to anything and saying, yes, that's what happened, okay. And then hope for the best that, okay, if I agree and cooperate, things won't go as bad for me as it might if I keep denying and saying.
Is there any evidence in terms of your client's mental and physical condition other than he had smoked crack 2 days earlier, that he had smoked marijuana the day before, and it appears, you know, there's nothing to indicate that he hadn't slept the night before, right? I mean, he reported to work, and he was arrested as he was reporting to work, right? And there's really nothing in the record to show what, I mean, and you're arguing that he was still under the influence of marijuana, that he had smoked more than 24 hours earlier. And is there anything in the record to show how long the effects of marijuana and or crack might last?
That was not covered.
Is there anything to suggest, is there anything in the record to show that he might have been withdrawing at the time?
Well, his statements, and let's say that the way he eventually caved in showed that there was, and also, I guess, listening to his tone of voice towards the end, you know, he's very soft-spoken and just saying yes to all these things, that there must be something going on.
All right. Kelly Colio says, you know, confessions remain subject to the totality of circumstances analysis and may still be the product of interrogation techniques that are, quote, so offensive to a civilized system of justice that they must be condemned under principles of due process. Are you asking this court to change that standard?
Well, yes, we are, because in this situation,
what standard are you proposing?
Well, still under the totality of the circumstances, but I don't think the court should be saying or giving a pass right from the start that says these intrinsic falsehoods are all right. There should maybe be a switch on the front, because the way it works now is the burden then becomes on the defendant to show that he was somehow affected or in what way he was affected, if the state is going to use, or the prosecutor or the police is going to use these kind of falsehoods, maybe the burden should be on them to show that.
Are you suggesting that the police need a good faith basis for the falsehoods?
No, to show.
In other words, in this case, it appears that other than because the complaining witness said that I think she didn't know who had hit her, right, because she had passed out. And when she came to, she says she came to your client basically sexually assaulting her, right? And so it seems that everything the police asked other than who hit her with the bottle, it appears to have been based on what she told the officer as to what had happened, or what she had told the police as to what had happened, in terms of the sequence of him being in her, and then his brother, cousin, and then him coming back, and then turning her around and penetrating her anus, right? So that was all based on what she had said. So I'm just wondering, I'm a little bit unclear as to what standard you're proposing. Are you saying that asking questions based on what the complaining witness says is an interrogation technique that is so offensive to a civilized system of justice that they have to be condemned?
We're looking at the DNA evidence.
Okay, so you're saying that you're basically saying lies should not be permitted, even if they're intrinsic, and get rid of this intrinsic-extrinsic thing.
That would be, in terms of public policy, the best solution.
If I might interrupt you at that point, Mr. Lum, we have, since the time of Kelly Calillo, perhaps, or certainly since the time that the court first, and I guess the United States Supreme Court first considered this issue about whether police officers should be permitted to not tell the truth, which was over 50 years ago, new forms of evidence have developed, such as DNA, right? So in terms of this particular case in deciding whether or not there was coercion, the analysis that focuses on DNA, I suppose to some extent, would have to do with how convincing is DNA, right? And in this case, let's assume that the condition of the suspect was such that he was coherent, he was listening, so much so, and was not under the influence of ice or marijuana, but was so clear in his thinking that he understood what DNA evidence was. Now, you made the point that I guess DNA evidence is quite convincing. So applying the standard that we have right now that accepts the fact that police officers can manufacture as much evidence, I guess, as they see fit, as long as it has to do with the facts of the particular case, accepting that proposition, at a certain point, coherent, clear-thinking person can be affected by an understanding that DNA evidence is available, correct? So under the totality of the circumstances here, would that be sufficient in your mind, even if the defendant was able to think clearly? Is that sufficient evidence of coercion that he was told there was legitimate DNA evidence?
We would argue that that could, in and of itself, because of DNA evidence's almost global reputation, that it's uncontrovertible and you cannot deny it. And in fact, that was one of the things that the police detective told Mr. Baker.
And if you assume, as most people, as you indicated, would, that police don't lie to you, virtually immediately when he was told that they had DNA evidence, he confessed. He admitted the sexual acts. Almost simultaneously.
Mr. Mr. Lum, thank you. And I will give you some rebuttal time at the end, although we've gone through your entire 30 minutes. The last 10 minutes that you reserved was a lot of questions that we had for you, so I will give you some rebuttal.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, Ms. McCullen, your argument.
May it please the Court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Sonia McCullen on behalf of the State of Hawaii. I just want to clear one thing up before I begin. When we're looking at intrinsic facts, it doesn't get an automatic stamp of approval. It doesn't become per se okay. It falls into, or it becomes a circumstance considered in the whole totality of circumstances. Now, when it's extrinsic, it's per se coercive. But intrinsic, it doesn't mean it has been deemed not per se coercive, but we do still consider it in the totality. When looking at the totality in this case, defendant's statement was voluntary. Starting with the Miranda warning, there was a Miranda warning given, both written and verbal. Defendant could read. He initialed each answer. He expressly indicated he understood his rights. He expressly indicated he was well enough to continue. The questioning or the interview itself was less than an hour. It was a one-on-one interview. The tone was conversational, and it was an intelligible conversation. The detective's job here is to find out the truth, to get to the truth. And he told the defendant that. I want to hear the truth from you, he said. The detective's tone throughout was pretty measured, pretty level-headed, pretty calm. He engaged defendant in a conversation, and he performed his job to get to the truth within acceptable boundaries.
What are those boundaries? That's really the issue, right? So let's put apart this case. Let's assume that you have a situation in which a woman alleges sexual assault. Everyone involved is extremely inebriated. The defendant can't even recall whether he was there. And the police say, we found your DNA. The defendant has blackout, you know, alcoholic blackouts. They happen, right? So the police say, we found your DNA. And then he says, yeah, I guess I must have done it. Right? I mean, well, is it not coercive to say that there is DNA when there isn't?
In your hypothetical, the whole point is to get to the truth, and then the defendant didn't tell the truth, or the accused didn't tell the truth in that instance. He truthfully didn't remember. And so that would have been the truth. I don't think saying, I found your DNA there, would make someone who didn't remember say, okay, I guess I did it. I didn't remember.
What's your response to Justice Pollack's question that the timing and the sequence was that the defendant gave a version which was largely or completely exculpatory up until the point when the defendant confronted him with the DNA, and it was at that point that he began acknowledging at least having sex with the CW. Does that suggest that statement had a particular impact on him?
Well, the defendant already knew about that because he said his father had called him was he on the bus or something? He had called him and said, I want you boys to turn yourself in, and something about they found your DNA in her or something. So he was already aware of possible DNA evidence. I don't think that was a turning point. I think he just tried two stories. He gave one version. He gave a second version. And the officer was firm. I know that's not true. I'm not. No, that didn't happen. And then, he was found out. He knew what he did to the girl, and he knows he can't lie about it anymore.
But I'm sorry, Justice Pollack. No,
but he is told at that point by the officer that they have DNA evidence, and it's at that point, I mean, if your theory is that he knew it before, then why didn't he admit it before? It's when the officer who he would have no idea, I don't think most of the American public would have any idea that it's okay for police to lie to you and say that they have evidence or physical evidence or some other, you know, way to implicate you in a crime, and you have no, and you're going to accept that. This is an eighth person with an eighth grade education. You're telling this person that there's DNA, and who wouldn't believe it?
Who wouldn't? Well, if the question is, so here we have the defendant who's sitting in a room with the officer, and the officer says, we have DNA evidence. She already tried to say one story, and the officer says, I don't believe it. He tried to give another story. The officer says, I don't believe it. We have proof. We have DNA proof. And then he says, okay. But case law has already determined that an officer saying, hey, I have DNA proof, is not going to procure an untrue statement if you didn't really do it. Maybe you have DNA evidence, but it's not mine.
There are at least one case that I know of where they did show somebody some false evidence, and based on that, they said that that goes into the totality of circumstance, and they said they suppressed it.
So
because it can.
And that's the proper, procedure here, is once it's found to be intrinsic, it goes into the totality, and we consider that along with everything else. Hey, he was given his Miranda warnings, the police lied to him, and then we go down the list.
Okay, let me ask you this then. How do you characterize the evidence as intrinsic or extrinsic when someone tells you, you don't want to be going down like this, you know, you don't want to be remembered this way, dude, you know what I mean?
I think intrinsic and extrinsic goes to the falsehood. I don't think that's considered a falsehood. It's just the officer's, hey, you got to tell it. We're here to find out the truth. You got to tell the truth.
Well, isn't this a collateral consequence? You mean you can tell an individual who's being interrogated that certain things that don't have anything that it could affect the media, and then he also tells them, look, when you go to court, he brings up court and tells the person, you think people want to hear that somebody effing deny all this when it's insurmountable evidence against them? Is that okay? If you don't confess, the media and court will think you're lying because we have physical evidence?
It was all part of the, hey, it's better for you if you tell us the truth. Just tell us the truth.
But that's not only what's being said. They're bringing in the media and they're bringing in the courts.
Well, he's bringing the media in context of, you know, it's better to find out from you than from the media. Why don't you tell us the truth? It's still within the, hey, that's the purpose of this interview. Let's get to the truth.
Would it be okay? Would it have been okay for this officer to say that there was DNA evidence when there wasn't, when there was no one saying that this defendant had engaged in, you know, sexual assault?
I think it's not per se coercive. It falls into the totality.
Aren't you saying that the use of DNA evidence is never coercive? Because I think your point was that if a person is not guilty, they will never.
Well,
I thought that was your statement. They would never confess. And so they can't possibly be coercive. Is that your position?
I think the use of a falsehood, or use of that falsehood, that we have DNA when the officer didn't have the DNA results at the time, is an intrinsic falsehood, and it goes to part of the totality.
I understand that you think it's intrinsic and it goes to the totality, but I'm trying to understand why you feel that way, and I thought you said Use of DNA evidence can't be coercive because if somebody is actually not guilty, they're not going to admit. Is that your position?
Well, Kelly Colio tells us that. Kelly Colio tells us that kind
was DNA involved in Kelly Colio?
I think it's one of the examples.
No, it was not involved in Kelly Colio. It had to do with making up the fact that there was evidence of sexual activity that took place in that case. DNA was not involved. Let me read to you a statement by Justice Brandeis. This was in 1928. Decency, security, and liberty alike demand that government officials shall be subjected to the same rules of conduct that are commands to the citizen. In a government of laws, existence of the government will be imperiled if it fails to observe the laws scrupulously. If the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. Now, what had happened in Kelly Colio is that the court made, I think, clear that there are times when the actions of the government can, in fact, overbear the will of the defendant, and it's not necessarily the case that just because it's intrinsic, you would find that there isn't coercion. And at this point, I would submit that the idea of police officers engaging in the manufacture of evidence has been established as being a very important part of training because Kelly Colio specifically identifies that. In that decision, Justice Levinson points out that there are now workshops that the police have where they discuss how to manufacture evidence for confessions. So wouldn't you think that at a certain point the use of intrinsic facts could end up being, like, for example, DNA could end up being coercive?
I'm sorry. I guess I have a little difficulty with the word manufacture evidence.
How about lie, purposely lie? For example, Justice Levinson cites seven different instances.
And that's the whole purpose of the voluntariness hearing, for a judge to take a look at the circumstances, to take a look at the, or to listen to the audio, like in this case, and make a determination. And
why is it a crime for a citizen to lie to the police and not a crime for the police to lie to citizens?
Why is it a crime not? I don't think it's a crime.
False report a crime. It is.
He's not false reporting a crime. It's one of the methods the police use that have been
determined. Not falsely reporting a crime when you state that an individual has committed a rape and that it's supported by DNA. You wouldn't think that that being reported to the police would be a crime?
I don't think that's what's happening here. I'm sorry, I disagree.
Well, in any case, when you discuss the circumstance that is confronting the defendant in terms of coercion, by its very nature, that's the basis of Miranda, right? That when an individual is in custody, being questioned by a police officer, it's inherently coercive, correct? It's inherently coercive. That's why the government has the burden to...
He's in custody, he's being considered interrogation, and so the Miranda warnings are given.
As long ago as 1961, the Supreme Court said, the essential premise underlying our entire system of criminal justice is that ours is an accusatorial and not an inquisitorial system, a system in which the state must establish guilt by evidence independently and freely secured, and may not by coercion prove its charge against an accused out of his own mouth. Now we have an industry where police officers are being trained in how to lie in a way that fits within, I guess, the definition of intrinsic that now includes DNA evidence. In other words, from your analysis, if it wasn't just a statement by the police officer, but he produced the analysis, the police officer works with the police department and creates false DNA evidence and gives it to the defendant.
Well, he's making a false statement regarding DNA.
So would it, in your view, not be legitimate for the police to actually manufacture the evidence, not only explain that it's false, but bring forward a manufactured DNA sample result from a test?
Well, just I think if any, that's the whole purpose of the voluntariness hearing. The court looks at the circumstances and determines whether there's coercion. And if there is, then the state can't use it. And that's
let me ask you, this
part of why the state should not be coercive. That's the I guess our reasons why we wouldn't want to be coercive. We don't want the officers to be coercive because we can't use it if it is.
Okay. Let me just follow up, because one of the things that we've been talking about is, for if the officer gives false evidence or something like that, says something false, and then this officer follows up later on in the interview and the officer says to the individual, look, I'm not playing games with you, right? What I'm telling you is straight up. I'm being straight up with you, and that's why I want you to be that way with me. And he asks him, have I been BSing you? But no, and he says, I'm not doing that. So again, that isn't true too. Because he has been playing games with him, and what he's telling him isn't straight up. So we have more falsities that follow these. And that all weighs in.
And that all becomes part of the totality of circumstances when looking at whether it's coercive. But on the other side, he's been given his Miranda warning. Despite his eighth grade education, he's very articulate. It's not his first go around with the criminal justice system.
Can I ask you something?
He holds his line on the, I didn't beat her. So all of that is considered when we look at these falsehoods. It's part of the totality.
Is there something unique in your mind or something about DNA evidence that might justify considering it more akin to extrinsic than intrinsic? I mean, in other words, it's not just a matter of saying we have some, you know, there's a witness who said something happened or the CW says something happened. It's, and it was sort of presented here, scientific certainty that shows that you had sex with her. Is there something about it that we should look at in that light as a special instance or something particularly problematic in the realm of what officers might do in terms of misrepresentations during the course of an interview? Or do you think it's the same analysis?
Possibly something that we could look at, but I would ask that it be applied prospectively, if it be a new rule.
Education, but as you mentioned, he reads very well and he's very articulate. DNA evidence can be wrong. Does he know that DNA, does he think that, is there any evidence in the statement that he's saying DNA evidence is infallible?
I think he does say something along the lines. He does say, I think he said something like, it's for sure. He said something along those lines.
I didn't hear you, I'm sorry.
I think he said something like, It's for sure. Along those lines. I don't have the quote, but there was something he felt DNA was.
What's your response to the suggestion that the officer was threatening him to go to the media, or there was an implicit threat that in some way there would be media attention given to this, but not if he were to confess or say what the officer thought he should say? What's your response to that?
When reading context, that's not the impression I get. When reading context, it's better for you to come forward and tell the truth than for the media to get a hold of it. So it's all part of the give me the truth.
But isn't that what you just said? It's better for you to tell me what I want to hear than for the media to get it. In other words,
not what I want to hear. The officer keeps saying the truth.
Well, you know something? That at one point in the transcript, after this individual has been subjected to some of the questions that the officer did. Mr. Baker finally says to him, what do you want, officer? Mustafa, answer. Anything you want to ask? In other words, at that point, Mr. Baker is just saying, what do you want from me, officer?
Oh, Mr. Baker's told that he understands the whole purpose of this interview. The officer said something along the lines of, what do you think they want to hear? And the defendant said, the truth. So even he knew the purpose of this interview was to get to the truth.
Well, whose truth? You know, at one point in there, in this, I don't know if I can find it, but he tells him, he's giving a sequence of events, and the officer says to him, you know, I don't know what you're remembering exactly what happened, because you were effed up. In other words, you were so drugged up. The officer acknowledges that he may not even know, Mr. Baker may not have known what happened, and then he tells him what happened.
Could I ask your help, Ms. McCollum? As you can see, I'm reaching for the need for, while an individual is in custody in an inherently coercive atmosphere, the need of police officers to fabricate evidence in order to get the defendant to confess. So why? Is it the case? I just don't see it in the materials. Why is it that law enforcement needs the opportunity to lie and make up evidence in order to perform their work? Do you want to give some explanation about it? I mean, if the police had to tell the truth, do you think that would mean that it would be very difficult for law enforcement to do its job?
Well, I think this case might be a good example. The first story the defendant told was, or the officer believed wasn't the truth. And then the officer gave him a second chance. And then he's again lied. And the officer again didn't believe it. And so, I mean, these are methods the officers use, but
well,
you have to stay within the boundaries.
You're an experienced prosecutor. Let's carry that through. Let's assume that the defendant successfully lies throughout the interview, and then the case proceeds. In this case, you have a person who was a victim that testified, right?
Yes.
I mean, do you think that there could well have been a conviction even if the defendant didn't confess in this case?
Yes. It would have been a more he said, she said. The victim testified.
Sort of, but it wasn't exactly he said, she said, because you had a doctor that confirmed the fact that it looked like she'd been raped, right?
Yes.
And you have an independent witness who saw her bloodied, throwing up clots of blood, her eyelid hanging down from being cut, her jaw broken, her can see her lip teeth through the cut in her lips. So it's not like it's
not, yeah. But on the other side, we do have Gabe testifying. It was all me. It wasn't him at all. And so there is I believe even without, we would have got a conviction.
You know, when the officer does talk, the detective does talk to Baker about the DNA, and you know what that means. And at that point in time, he goes, yeah, I know, but I did not beat her up. I mean, he's not subject to this overborne, yes, DNA is going to make me confess to everything. That's the first thing he said, okay, but I didn't beat her up. So he admits he had sexual intercourse.
I'm sorry, where's the reference? You said there was a reference to the father having told him that there was DNA evidence?
I believe so. That was my recollection.
Okay.
I don't...
Okay, if you don't have it, we can review and look for it.
Maybe on page 13, maybe?
Okay, we can look. We'll review the transcript and look for it.
Sorry.
Thank you. No, I don't.
Well, in conclusion, If there's no further questions, based on the totality, even with the falsehoods, the defendant's statement was voluntary. When we look at he was given his Miranda rights, the tone of the whole interview, the defendant's answers, his ability to deny, it was voluntary.
I do have one follow-up question on the sentencing issue. What was the sentence for the other defendant? Because there's an argument of disproportionality. Was the other defendant charged as a juvenile?
As far as I can tell, and from the record, there was some statements that he was adjudicated in juvenile court.
Okay.
It sounds like by the time this was being litigated, he wasn't in custody. He was maybe on probation, it sounds like.
It was a juvenile disposition. Okay.
But he was 15 at the time of the offense, right?
Yes.
So he wasn't waivable.
No, I don't believe so.
Doesn't sound like he was waived. Okay. Thank you.
Very well. Anything further, Ms. McCall?
Nothing.
All right. Some brief rebuttal, Mr. Lum.
Thank you very much. I'll briefly go into some rebuttal and then maybe into the parts regarding the consecutive sentencing.
Mr. Lum, that wasn't part of her argument, and I am going to give you rebuttal time, I think.
Okay.
So,
all right.
You know, if
all right. So I'll just go. I did notice. I think referring to that page 13 of the interview, it does. He says, Mr. Baker tells a police officer regarding when he was arrested. My dad calls me up, saying the cops want to talk to me because they found my blood at the scene or whatever, and my brother's coming, this girl. And all I told my dad was, Dad, I didn't. I tried to help. And he said, well, I just let you two guys turn yourself in. So the father did not tell him there was DNA evidence.
But they said blood?
He said they found your blood at the scene, whatever, and my brother's coming.
Was there such evidence of his blood at the scene?
No, we believe that all the blood that they found on the concrete was the complaining witness. So I don't know where the father would have gotten that information. And, you know, there was other parts where it appeared that Mr. Baker was not given complete information beforehand because he seemed to believe that the complainant was in a coma.
So when Mr. Baker stated that he had to clean up Gabe by cleaning the blood off him, he was cleaning the victim's blood off of Gabe.
That could be it, yes. So the first mention regarding DNA evidence was actually, we believe, from the police detective of Tokita. I believe that was on, I think, page... Okay. I believe page 21 of the interview, and he made it clear once again that he could not deny it because he said, that's why I know there's physical evidence that you guys cannot deny because there's DNA in there, and you know that DNA is one of a kind. Yeah, you know what I mean. And then he says, that's only one person. So in Mr. Baker's mind, from what he's heard before, only one person could have been the one to supply the DNA. And if he's telling him that he was that person, he believes is incontrovertible. The next, the officer says, exactly, so I know what happened already because there's physical evidence. And then he says, yeah. So it was the officer who brought up there being DNA evidence.
Okay, if both the officer says this and Mr. Baker says, there's only one person, and he knows Gabe had raped her, why would that make Baker want to confess?
No, he's trying to make it out that it was Baker's DNA that was found at the scene because initially, you know, Baker did admit that he had seen his brother having sex with the girl.
You guys cannot deny this because there's DNA in there. And you know DNA is one of a kind, but what the defendant says is there's only one person. Mm. How does that make him think that his DNA is in there, other than the blood? Obviously, his father tells him they got his blood.
No, we believe that he was stating that his understanding was that if they found DNA evidence, it would only have come from him, him being that one person.
Anything further, Mr. Lum?
I didn't have a chance, but when they asked a question regarding the juvenile, I think it was in the pre-sentence report that the juvenile's case was adjudicated in family court, and so if he was not waived, he would have been subject to, I believe the maximum would have been only in custody until 21, and it did not appear that he was even in custody at the time of Mr. Baker's sentencing. So his sentence was far, far shorter than what Mr. Baker received from the court.
Very well. Anything further from the court? Yeah. Anything further, Mr. Lum, at this time?
Nothing further then.
All right. Thank you to both of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement. Mm-hmm.